New Year's Day, 1929. Most of Los Angeles is still sleeping. The San Fernando Valley sits quiet in the January chill, and out at Metropolitan Airport, five Army officers are doing what pilots do before a long flight. Checking things twice, drinking terrible coffee, not talking much. In a few minutes they will climb into a trimotor airplane called the Question Mark, point the nose into a gray California morning, and not come back down for 6 days. I'm Taildragger. You're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and I have been sitting on this story for a while, because some stories deserve a little time to do them right. Pull up a chair. The airplane was a Fokker trimotor. Big corrugated aluminum wings, slab-sided fuselage, three right whirlwind, radial engines thundering away on the nose and the wingtips. An army transport built to haul soldiers or cargo, not exactly a precision machine, not built for beauty. Built for work, they had stripped out most of the cargo fittings and put in a few cots, some extra equipment, and a large auxiliary oil tank. They needed to stay light where they could. The fuel they would be carrying up there was not going in these tanks. The fuel was going to come from above, passed down through a hose from other aircraft while the Question Mark kept flying. And that was the question painted on the nose in bold letters. How long can an airplane stay in the air if you keep feeding it what it needs? Nobody knew. They were going to find out. The crew was five men, and this is the part of the story that puts a knot in your throat if you know what came later. Major Carl Spatz was in command. His nickname was Tui, and there was nothing flashy about him. He was a quiet, methodical officer, a combat veteran from the First World War who had shot down three German aircraft over the Western Front. A planner, a man who thought through problems before they became emergencies. He would end his career as the first chief of staff of the United States Air Force.
Captain Ira Eaker was beside him. Spatz and Eaker were already a team, already friends, the kind of working pair where each man knows exactly what the other is going to do before he does it. Eaker was precise and relentless and possessed of what his colleagues described as an iron constitution. He did not get airsick. He did not panic. He wrote everything down. Over the next 6 days, he would fill a flight log with some of the most detailed aeronautical observations anyone had ever committed to paper. Lieutenant Elwood Quesada, everyone called him Pete, 25 years old, the youngest man on the crew. He would go on to command the 9th Tactical Air Command in France after D-Day, the officer responsible for coordinating the fighter bombers that tore apart the German columns at the front. Lieutenant Harry Halverson, steady and capable, and Sergeant Roy Hu, the mechanic. His name gets listed last, but his hands may have mattered most. We will get to that. They lifted off just after 7 in the morning. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you have earned it, they have got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. The plan was to fly a racetrack pattern over the San Fernando Valley, staying within reasonable range of the airport, and accept fuel from a pair of Army tanker planes assigned to keep them topped off. Those tankers would take turns climbing up above the Question Mark, dropping down alongside and lowering a hose. The fuel would flow by gravity. A man in the Question Mark would reach out of a hatch in the top of the fuselage, grab the trailing hose, wrestle it into the fuel filler on the wing, and hold it there until the tank was full. That is what aerial refueling looked like in 1929. Two airplanes holding tight formation while a man leaned out of one of them into the prop wash and grabbed a garden hose. There was no radio intercom between the aircraft. They communicated by hand signals and written notes, passed up and down on the fuel hose itself. When the Question Mark crew needed something, they scrawled it on a piece of paper, tied it to the hose line, and let the tanker crew haul it back up. This was their telephone, a wet piece of paper on a rubber hose over the San Fernando Valley. The first refueling contact went fine. The second went fine. By the end of day one, they had a rhythm. And by day two, they had an audience. Word spread across Los Angeles that five Army aviators were trying to set an endurance record, and the public decided this was the most compelling thing happening in Southern California. Crowds gathered at the airport. People drove out to hilltops around the valley to watch the trimotor drone past. The newspapers sent photographers up in their own airplanes to get pictures. Radio stations were carrying regular updates. People were stopping strangers on the street to ask if anyone had heard how the boys in the airplane were doing. There was something about the sight of that airplane, still up there when you went to bed, and still up there in the same sky when you woke up the next morning, that reached into people in a way that is genuinely difficult to explain in an era where commercial jets are background noise. In January of 1929, there were grandmothers alive who had been born before the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk. People who had grown up in a world where human flight was still a rumor, still an almost theological promise. and here was an airplane that had been flying for 3 days straight and was not coming down. Letters were delivered to Metropolitan Airport addressed simply to the crew of the question mark. Most were notes of encouragement. Some were from women asking if the men were eating enough. The answer to that question was, sort of. Meals were passed up during refueling contacts. Thermoses of hot coffee, sandwiches and paper wrappings. Sometimes the tanker crew would heat something up and bundle it into the transfer package. Eaker noted in the flight log on day 3 that someone had sent up chicken, and he noted this approvingly. One brief sentence, no further elaboration. A man of discipline. Back inside the cabin, the romance of the Enterprise had evaporated somewhere around hour 36. The cabin smelled of oil and exhaust and aviation gasoline, a chemical cocktail that was baked into everything they wore, everything they ate, everything they breathed. The engines were right outside the fuselage, 3 of them, running wide open, producing a vibration and a roar that went beyond sound into something physical, something you felt in your jaw and your chest and the backs of your knees. They slept in shifts on the cots bolted into the aft section, 2 or 3 hours at a stretch. It was not restful sleep. You cannot sleep restfully when your bed is hammering at 1,000 revolutions per minute. The refueling hatch was in the top of the fuselage, and when it opened for a contact, the cold January air poured in along with a mist of fuel spray and the deafening roar of the tanker aircraft flying formation overhead. Whoever was working the hatch would lean out sometimes almost to the waist, watching the hose swing down in the prop wash, timing the oscillation, grabbing it when the geometry was right. Some contacts took 20 minutes. Some took longer. When the transfer was done, you closed the hatch, wiped the fuel off your jacket, and went back to whatever you were doing. 43 times over 6 days. 43 times they opened that hatch. They had blown past the existing endurance record by day 3 and kept going. Now here's where it gets interesting. Because somewhere around day 4, the airplane started complaining. Oil consumption on the center engine began to creep upward. Engine temperature followed. Sergeant Hu, who had been monitoring everything methodically from the moment the wheels left the ground, went to work. He crawled through the cabin to reach what he could reach. He tightened fittings. He checked connections. He traced the system until he found an oil line seeping at a junction deep in the engine compartment. He found it. He fixed it on a running engine. In an airplane at altitude over populated Southern California, the temperature came down. The oil pressure stabilized. Crisis for the moment averted. This happened more than once. An exhaust ring on another engine cracked under the sustained heat of continuous operation. It needed to be replaced. On the ground, this is an afternoon's work with the engine cold and a full set of tools. In the air, with everything running and the airplane at a few thousand feet, this is a different proposition entirely. Who did it anyway? I want to be clear about something. Roy Hu was an enlisted man, a sergeant, at a time when the distance between the officers and the enlisted was formal and significant. He was on this crew to keep the engines running, and he kept them running with everything he had for 6 days straight. Every story about the question mark puts spots on the marquee. Every story rightly honors Eaker. Roy Hu is the reason they had anything to be honored for. Day 5, past 120 hours. Well past any point that had ever been reached before, the engines were accumulating small distresses, the kind that don't individually matter but collectively add up toward a reckoning. The tanker crews were rotating. Fresh pilots, taking fresh aircraft up for their shift, then landing, resting, going back up. The question mark crew had no rotation. Same 5 men. Same tired faces. Same smell of gasoline and hot metal. 40 refueling contacts. 41, 42. Day 6. January 7th. They were past 140 hours. The center engine started throwing oil again. This time the pressure drop was steadier, more insistent. Who worked on it? The pressure did not recover the way it had before. There was something deeper in that engine that could not be reached from the cabin, something that would eventually give out if they kept pushing. Spots conferred with the crew. The airplane could sustain flight on 2 engines, but a forced landing after 6 days aloft, with a tired crew and a compromised power plant, introduced a level of risk that had nothing to do with glory. They had already proven everything they came up here to prove. The data existed. The record was beyond any reasonable challenge. The point was made. It was time to come down. At 12 minutes past 1 in the afternoon on January 7, 1929, the Fokker trimotor named question mark touched down at Metropolitan Airport. The wheels kissed the runway 150 hours, 40 minutes, and 14 seconds after they had left it. They had covered approximately 11,000 miles in an oval over the San Fernando Valley. They had completed 43 aerial refueling contacts. The crowd was enormous. Tens of thousands of people by some accounts. The road outside the airport was lined with cars stretching back half a mile. Spots stepped out of the airplane. He looked at the ground for a moment, then he looked up, squinting a little in the January light. He asked if there was coffee. There was. The Army Air Corps took Eaker's flight logs and went to work. Every engine temperature reading, every fuel state entry, every notation about what broke and how Huey repaired it, fed directly into the doctrine and technology that would shape American air power for the next two decades. The question mark proved that aerial refueling was operationally viable at a scale nobody had demonstrated. The strategic logic of it was immediate: bombers flying out of England that could reach deep into Germany, patrol aircraft ranging across the Pacific, power that did not have to come home when the tanks ran low. The architecture of American air power in the Second World War. You can trace a direct line from that architecture back to a gray January morning over the San Fernando Valley. Spots commanded United States Strategic Air Forces in Europe. He was at Reims when Germany surrendered. He was in Tokyo Bay when Japan surrendered. There was an airplane nearby both times. There had always been an airplane nearby.
Eaker commanded the 8th Air Force through the most brutal stretch of the strategic bombing campaign, when the losses were staggering and the political pressure to scale back was enormous. He never flinched. He believed in what air power could do, and he had believed it since standing at the fuel hatch of the question mark over Los Angeles. Quesada became the tactical air commander, whose fighter bombers helped crack the German line at Normandy. Eisenhower called him one of the most effective air commanders of the war, and Roy Hu went home knowing what he had done. Some questions are worth asking even when you're not sure of the answer. The men who climbed into the question mark on New Year's morning did not know how long they could stay up. They went anyway. They found out. And what they found out shaped the air war that was coming 15 years down the road in ways they could not have imagined standing on that ramp. In the January chill, that airplane, that oil-stained, exhaust-blackened, garden hose-refueled trimotor, is why the United States had the air power it had when the world needed it. Remember that. Primary sources for today's story include Ira Eaker's original flight logs preserved at the Air Force Historical Research Agency, James Parton's biography, Air Force Spoken Here, and archival records from the National Museum of the United States Air Force. You can find more at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up.